So today, just to be frank, today we actually have to do something hard. This is probably harder than anything we've done all semester. I don't know how successful we'll be at it, but we'll try our best at putting this together.
Are we finishing this?
I have no idea. Okay, so we are reading a tshuva, so that takes some effort to try to understand what a tshuva is. And then we'll try and figure out what this particular tshuva is.
So far we've learned like tshuva is like a persuasive essay, but it's also very poetic.
Ah, okay, yeah, so we see persuasive halachic rhetoric, but it can be done in high style. But we saw in the Ma'arik that our understanding of what was happening could be changed by recognizing that it happened in a particular context, not just historical context, but a very particular context, namely that somebody else had written about the same case previously. So here, right here, we find out fairly early, although more dramatically in the version in the Tshuvot, I think, than in the version in Yom Shel Shlomo, is that this case had previously been submitted to a rabbi who I think would say seems to have been recognized by the community as a fairly competent rabbinic figure. And that rabbi had paskin very clearly in one direction. Okay, so let's set our case. We have one person who has some kind of original license to sell whiskey, and then there's a very complicated back and forth in which a second person somehow comes in, and that second person somehow ends up with the license to sell whiskey and a royal edict saying that he's supposed to have the license to sell whiskey, right? Yes, am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
No?
Well,
yeah,
you're okay. Correct, but the first guy thought he got it underhandedly, and the second guy claims that he got it.
Yes, right. There's a conflict about how exactly, about who exactly was the ethical briber, right? That fundamentally, or was there a fair bidding practice? Now, the previous rabbi had ruled in favor of the initial owner of the license. And he had ruled that the second person, B, right, we're not going to use Rivin and Shema because they reverse in the Tshuvot, right, but B, owed A damages. And this is the, right, and then A comes to the Marshal, and he reports the case to him. It doesn't seem as if the Marshal has a written copy of the tshuva, because he has A comes to him and reports to him what the first Dayan said. We'll call him Dayan X. Right? And Dayan X said that he quoted a tshuva from the Sefer Rokeach, and the Sefer Rokeach said, being Masig Gvul is really, really bad, and you should not do it. And went on. Okay, so now what I want to set out is, what is the standard? Right, if the Marshal is writing this tshuva, so what is the point of writing this tshuva? It's not an essay. Right, it's a tshuva. It's written to a particular case. Right, so what is he trying to accomplish? Writing this tshuva, yes?
As Yaakov said, he's trying to accomplish showing that the first rabbi was completely, completely wrong.
Why does he need to show the first rabbi was completely, completely wrong? Is his goal just to embarrass the first rabbi?
Well, A, with the claim that Dine Mamanot should have been done with three, not just one.
That's how he does it. But why, right? But why is he doing this? Right, why must he prove the other rabbi wrong?
So that it's accepted, because the other rabbi is a respected rabbi. So he has to use everything he has to show that this person's wrong, most likely because he believes that people should be left to compete. Or something along those lines.
Let's make it even sharper. Yes, Yaakov. He doesn't want people being put in harem. So these are both abstract commitments that he has.
Maybe he doesn't like either people being put in harem or other people thinking that they have the wherewithal put in
harem. But so you and Elliot are both saying these very abstract commitments. Elliot thinks he has an abstract commitment to open, right, to free market competition or to fairly competitive markets. And you think he has an abstract commitment to against harem. All right, so let's be much more concrete and perhaps a little bit more cynical. Yes, Ellie.
Maybe he wants to not get involved.
Not get involved?
Yeah, to limit the power of Besdin. And he's saying that he wants to let the competition...
Okay, that's a long Eliot, competition.
But more than that, he not saying that he wants to allow competition, he wants to not get Besdin involved.
I don't know, he's pretty darn involved.
Because he can't say no to the question.
So he can't say no. So against his will, he's being forced to answer this question, and he is doing so. But he is writing a classic judicial opinion about the importance of judicial restraint.
It's like a libertarian writing for
yeah. Okay, right. Okay. Really, more concrete, more cynical. Yes, Jenna.
Competition and a decision such as this one.
Okay, so yesterday, Avi pointed out that I am often highly irreverent in Shir, and I promote a perhaps highly irreverent attitude to the text we're doing. This can't perhaps be justified by a story Rabbi Norman Lamb told us in Shir. He said, the Rav turned to him and said, Lamb, the problem with you is that when you come to Shir, you leave your Yetzirah at the door. You need your Yetzirah to learn. Okay, so I am encouraging you to write this is, although I think this is the cause of the worst evil in the world when people use their Yetzirah and they believe they're acting L'shem Shemayim. But let's write, but there's like a really, really cynical way you could frame this. I'm going to frame it that way. Okay, Judah.
Okay, well, going back to our conversation last night at dinner, right, this rabbi thinks that what the other rabbi did was absolutely wrong. He messed up Torah, so he needs to be called out for it.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, so he's animated by just this other rabbi is just a bad, bad Lamdan. And people need to know he's a really bad Lamdan.
At least in this case.
Okay. Yaakov.
He was personally affronted by the first Dayan's decision that this was already come out.
Okay. So yes, Elliot.
Maybe he has economic interest in ruling
favor. Maybe he has a client. That's the simplest way of framing it. Already he has a client.
But A came to him in the first place.
Right.
A came to him.
Some money over the table, and you know.
But was the rabbi ruled in favor?
Well, what's
No. The other. Sorry, A didn't come to him first. No, so the.
He just told us.
We clarified the case.
Right. So I think it's that A.
Shade.
A and B have this case. They go to this other rabbi. This other rabbi B is not as trusting of this other rabbi as A. And so he tells Rabbi X, I think you should bring other people. Rabbi X says, Nah, just me is enough. And then Rabbi X issues a ruling that goes completely against B. So B comes back to the Marshal and says what Rabbi X said, and this is the Marshal's response. So,
should
it come to him first? That is perhaps, like, I don't know if A would have come to him. But the purpose of this tshuva is to make sure that B doesn't have to pay. Right, you don't have to be deeply cynical and explain right and say why B didn't have to pay. But the purpose of the tshuva is so that B doesn't have to pay. Now, here's why this matters. Because it's not enough to write a tshuva saying that Rabbi X is wrong for B not to have to pay, because B signed the binding arbitration agreement with a recognized rabbi who ruled. So this is a pretty stark thing. He's taking on. Right, Rabbi X is the dayan of such a city. Right, he's not a katli kaniv agme. Right, he's not a reed cutter in the swamp. He is by all accounts a recognized rabbi. So, what is the standard which you need in order to overturn a halachic ruling in a case where both parties accepted jurisdiction by a recognized rabbi? Yes, you have to be toev dvar mishnah, which means you have to have. Right, you have to have made an error that is not in any way justifiable. The classic case is you have to have missed the primary source, but it has to be one. Right, it has to be one that you can't possibly call it a judgment error, because if it's a judgment error, we call it a tu'upi shikul adat. Even if it's wrong, it's not reversible. So the marshal has no choice if he wants to accomplish this. He has no choice. But to say the person has no justification at all. He cannot leave him any argument. Because if there's any defense left for the initial position, then he does not change the verdict. All he does is gain the abstractions of supporting free markets. And what was the other one?
Not liking
Cherem. Not liking Cherem, right. But I want to say that, no, I think what he's trying to do is he wants to overturn the verdict, and there's really only the only way he can do that is by claiming that Rabbi X is indefensible. So all that nice little piece, where he said, that would be saying, right, where he says, and I thought I had to be Melamed Tzchut for him to see, right, maybe there's one rabbi in 1,000, even though he'd still be wrong, right, but even if there's one rabbi in 1,000 who supports him, I should do that so as not to embarrass him. And if, Nebuch, it turns out there's not even one rabbi in 1,000 who supports him, well, right, there was that great line, right, Elokim Matzah Tavon Avdo, right, and there's nothing he can do. That's what the standard he has to meet in this tshuva is, and that's a very hard standard to meet. And the question is, to what extent that justifies hyperbole, if that's the standard you have to meet? And do you think, in the end, that he meets anything resembling the standard of making the other position indefensible? Yes, Yaakov?
Have we answered, why does he want A to win?
We don't know.
Okay.
Right? We don't know. Maybe he's just animated by a sense that a real injustice was committed.
He wants B to win.
Maybe he just really thinks that injustice was committed. Maybe he really is committed to free markets. Right? Maybe he's had a vicious political battle with Diane X for years and years, and he thinks Diane X is a fraud. And this is his chance. Who knows? We don't know, right? As far as I know, we can't go behind the text, although there may be a history somewhere that explains that there are many tshuvot like this, and that there is a character in one of Primo Levi's books, my love, is a chemist who sits around 10 months a year doing nothing, waiting for this other chemist in America to publish an article, and then he swings into action and shows that the experiment is non-replicable and publishes the result disproving the other guy. It's his whole career. It's just matching the other guys.
Is it called Waiting for Dr. Godot?
No. So it could be. The Marshal seems to have had an active life as well, but it could be. It could be that was, I don't know. But I think that to understand this tshuva, you have to recognize that there is no partial success in this tshuva. Right? If he ends up convincing you that you should paskin this way in the future, he has failed. Right? What he has to do is he has to let B say, I defy you, Diane X, because your decision was so wrong, I don't have to pay attention to you.
So no quarter.
Yes.
No prisoners.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How does this, within this this law structure, what does that mean about the other Dayan's credibility?
Well, if he wins, then the other Dayan is likely to lose a lot of credibility, because there's no real point in going to somebody for binding arbitration if you know a person's going to get overturned. You want to say something?
Just a question. I read it, but you said that they signed a binding arbitration agreement. Is that in the tshuva?
Yeah. They were Mekabel Kinyan Sudar. Right? And they said that they would accept the tshuva. It's about as explicit as you can be.
How common are tshuvas of this nature in others? Because what you're saying makes sense. So in that sense, it's an unusual tshuva, right? Because it's trying to not answer questions, it's trying to reverse another opinion.
I don't know how unusual it is. I don't think it's unknown.
I don't think it's super unusual either.
Right, I don't think it's unknown. I think that's probably part of the way in which people survive and don't survive is you don't survive if other people write compelling tshuvot claiming you're wrong, and you survive by establishing your authority over the people. That's how your book, right? I think that's probably right. So I think probably our tshuvot have a disproportionate number of such things. That's not the first one I've seen.
No.
And we saw the Marik was basically doing the same thing, just without a binding arbitration agreement. And he's building off the Marik. Okay. Now he has a very complicated argument. What I tried to do for you was to outline it so that you can understand to some degree what he's trying to do, but this actually doesn't even do half the work, the outline, because you still have to figure out how each of these steps fits in. Now, the first thing, just to be aware of his language, so that the Marshal's verbal trademark seems to be Ve'ein Lomar Ze'eno. Right, so he starts off saying, Ve'ein Lomar, don't say this, right? Right? Because and then he goes ahead and says it, and he says, "Zeno," right? That's wrong, right? So, so he warns you up front, this is going to be wrong, and then he tells you it's wrong, and then he tells you why it's wrong. Right? But that's so. If you were trying, if I had just given you a blank page of the Maharshal, when you're trying to figure out how do you structure a Maharshal, so one of the things you look for is the Aleph Lamids and the Zion. Right, and the Zion Alephs, and you realize that the Aleph Lamas are not the Afshar Lamar, and the Zion Alephs are not Zodomeret. Right, so it goes to abbreviations, but his abbreviations are unique. It's Ve'en Lamar, and or Ve'en Lachshot, and Ze'eno. And the way he structures it is first he sets out a claim, and then he sets out what you write, and you might object to it because of this. That would be wrong. You might object to it because of this, because I might be wrong. You might object to this because I might be wrong. That's what I try, right? If I were formatting the whole tshuva, right? So we would indent at those points. Yes.
Is that his mode of reasoning? Or is that the standard amongst commentators of that time?
I don't know enough about. I don't have enough historical consciousness, and nor do I know enough 16th century tshuva to know. My suspicion is that it's not. It is neither unique nor totally weird, right? You know, people have different verbal things, but that's a fairly standard way of doing it, right? Okay, so now let's try and figure out what he does substantively. So if we look at the substantive structure, so he spends a lot of time making most of the tshuva takes you through points. Where is he? Point six. Right, so the tshuva has 15 points, and the vast majority of it takes you up to point. Right, takes you up to point six. Point seven feels to me, and so I pulled it out for you yesterday, like a standalone essay that he put in the middle of the tshuva. And as we'll talk about, we'll see whether. Hopefully, you realize that if you read the tshuva, if you just read his classifications, then you read the case, you would in no way have predicted that he would say that the other person's decision is indefensible. There'll be one way which is absolutely concrete, in which his classification completely undermines one of his arguments. And it seems to me that what happened was that he wrote a long tshuva, he realized almost nobody's going to follow it, so he wrote a nice little summary of the intellectual parts, and then he went on. And then you have that. Okay. And then at the end, he all of a sudden throws in a whole lot of arguments that are really not about the competition issue, really not about the competition issue at all. There are a whole set of smaller issues responding to other kinds of arguments that you might have made in this context. So we have to figure out why he spends so much time on points 1 through 6. What are the what's the intellectual gain he has from it? Okay, so he starts right. This is point one. He starts by essentially presenting Tosfot. Right, what he says is there's a machloket Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam about whether the case of ani mahapech becharora, which yields the result nikra rasha. These are two versions of the tshuva. Right, if you don't realize, there's a version in Yashal Shlomo, a version in the tshuva, and so they're each of them has typos. So I set them up together. So he starts off by presenting a very standard presentation. Rashi holds that ani mahapech becharora, resulting in Nikra Rasha, applies even in cases of Hefker, and Rabbeinu Tam says not. And then there are two cases which pose problems for Rabbeinu Tam. One is the fish case, because the fish presumably are Hefker. The other is the olive case, because the olive tree presumably is Hefker. And he has the two exceptions for that. Right? One, the fish is a case of Yorid Lumnaso, and the olive is a case of Tircha and Smichat Dat. And that yields, right? That yields that Rashi holds that you're called a Rasha in all cases of Hefker. Rabbeinu Tam says you're not called it in case of Hefker unless there is Yorid Lumnaso or Tircha Smichas Das. Yes.
So it seems like he's holding to a formal distinction between Hefker Mitzia and Schora, because he doesn't bring in the there are a lot of fish in the sea argument.
That's true. He doesn't bring it in yet. At least not yet. Yes, Avi. Okay, so now, right? So as we get to page two, right? We have really he hasn't said anything. He hasn't said anything unusual. Now, the top of page two, he makes an assertion where he says, "Rov hagaonim hiskimu leperish Rabbeinu Tam." Okay, now by Gaonim, he doesn't mean what we call Gaonim. He means his predecessors. Because his list, he lists them. Right, there's the Balei HaTosfot, Rabbeinu Tam, the Ri, the Maharam, and the Rush. And he thinks that that they are Basroi, they're later. I don't, later than whom is not clear to me. And he ends up with Maram paskening that way, halacha l'maaseh, although he agrees that the Ran quotes the Ramban agreeing with Rashi. Okay, and all these are all things we have seen, although we saw the Ramban directly. All right, so he says, if you look at it, this fundamentally, right, fundamentally, we, it seems like you're saying we paskin like Rabbeinu Tam against Rashi. And there's no Nikarusha, there's no Anemahapech Becharara by Hefker. And for some reason, that doesn't satisfy him. Right, v'cholzeh enyanu shavelo. Kol eis, right, so long as there is, Rashbam. Right, Rashbam, he says, even Rashbam, right, even Rashbam, and he's going to put enormous amounts of effort, right, he has 6 points to right, enormous parts of effort to show that that Rashbam agrees with Rabbeinu Tam and disagrees with Rashi. So we have to try and figure out, we understand this tshuva, why does it matter to him so much? If he already has an overwhelming majority, and he has a psak halacha maaseh, why does he have to get Rashbam dafka? Yes, Elliot?
Well, I thought it was because Rashbam is usually considered to be one of the Tosafot.
Yeah.
So if you have one of the Tosafot disagreeing with Rabbeinu Tam, that really does take away a lot of Rabbeinu Tam's power.
Okay, so you think it undermines his robe. So Rashbam is just this critical point because Rashbam is a major Baal Tosfot and undermines the Tosfistic consensus.
Yes.
So that, I don't know. My sense is not so much, but it's certainly a, given the question, that's a reasonable interpretation of the evidence, and it's just a question if you know historically whether that would be such a big deal. And even if I don't think it's such a big deal, you know, maybe in the 16th century it was such a big deal. But my sense is that Rashbam is not a major Posig.
Is that your sense from your lectures?
That is not, that is, there could be an unconscious bias because of my campaign against Rashbam and Chumash.
I meant based on your lectures with Dr. Salvation.
No, that wasn't.
Because he would be someone who probably wouldn't
know. So you were there, mallet smashing, right? Mallet smashing two different. Okay, yesterday.
Could it be that he's trying, like, the whole tshuva was trying to demonstrate that the other time was told the Divine Mishnah that he wants to take every opportunity to show where one could have made a mistake, and that's why he's like going after Rashbam?
So it could be, right, that we don't need a standard anywhere near as high as Eliot set out. It's just, right, Rashbam is not enough to undermine Rabbeinu Tam's authority, but he is somebody that the other Dayan could rely on. And if the other Dayan is left with Rashi plus Rashbam, so then it's hard to say it was Toeb Bidvar Mishnah, because a reasonable person could paskin like Rashi, Rashbam, and Ramban against Rabbeinu Tam and Maharam and all that. Right? A reasonable person could, once a reasonable person could do it, he loses. So Rashbam is the tipping point between Toeb Bidvar Shikul HaDat and Toeb Bidvar Mishnah. Right, that would be a plausible interpretation. It doesn't satisfy me either.
Well, you can say it differently.
I don't think any technical, no technical solution is going to satisfy me.
If that's interpretation, you lose once you get to Rashi, right?
Because what?
If that's the reason, you lose once you're against Rashi.
So that's one problem, is that even Rashi would be enough.
But the point is, he needs to make Rashbam not like Rashi, because you need Rashi to basically be thrown out.
Yeah, so I understand that argument, and I think it's a reasonable argument, and it still doesn't satisfy me. So I have to see, right? I'm going to try and make a claim as we go through it, which I haven't worked out completely myself, but I'm going to try and set out a claim, and you'll see if you find it viable. Yes, Tova?
Is he worried that this specific Tana of Rashbam is an exception that the Rabbeinu Tam would also be Moda to, in which case his whole argument falls apart?
Close. Let's hold that. Close. Okay, so now, he says that Rashbam agrees as well. Now, the problem with this is, so now, Rashi we have on most of Talmud. Rashbam we only have on Bava Basra and Psachim. We don't have Rashi on the sections we have Rashbam on. All right, so that's why you can't really.
In
Psachim we have an early whatever draft, right? But for our Cheskes Habatim we don't. All right. So the interesting thing is, what is presented to him is there is a machloket Rashbam and Rabbeinu Tam in Bava Basra that looks just like the machlokas, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam in Kedushin. And the thrust of his argument to say is, don't think that just because there's a Machlokas Rashbam and Rabbeinu Tam in Bava Basra that looks just like the Machlokas Rashbam, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam in Kedushin, they're not the same Machlokas at all. Rashbam really agrees with Rabbeinu Tam over there, and his position here is a narrow position.
Wait, in Kedushin it's
Rabbeinu
Tam and Rashi?
In Kedushin it's Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi. Right, Rashi says that it applies to Hefker, Rabbeinu Tam says it doesn't. In Bava Basra, it's Rashbam and Rabbeinu Tam. Rashbam says he's called a Rasha in a case which appears to be Hefker. And Rabbeinu Tam says he's not called a Rasha in a case which appears to be Hefker. So somebody who's interested in tight arguments, right, a parsimonious thought, will say, well, look, if we know there's a machloket there about whether you're called a Rasha, but you're called a Rasha by Hefker, and Rabbeinu Tam is certainly consistent, and Rashbam is just filling in the commentary in Rashi in the place where Rashi didn't finish it, so why don't we just assume that this is the same machloket? So this is his big jump. No, don't think that. It's just a coincidence. Yeah, well, it's not right. It's not the same machloket. It just so happens that they line up that way.
That would be absurd, right? Just because they happen to be on the same place on the page, you'd think Rashi and Rashbam would agree.
No, not the same place. Because it's another case, right? Here's the machloket about whether you become a Rasha by Hefker, and here we have a case which is Hefker, and one person says you're called a Rasha, one person says you're called, you're not.
So the Marshal's chiluk is obvious, no?
Obvious. Let's get there.
Maybe obvious to you.
Okay.
Which
chiluk? Frame the chiluk. Yes, go ahead. What is the Marshal's chiluk?
Meaning in the case in the Rashi's case here in here over here you did.
Over here is
in Bava Basra.
Yes, which is the case of Nichsei Avdei Kochavim.
Right.
Harei Kimidbar. Yeah.
Right. It's a case of Hefker that I laid out money for.
Okay. Right. So there is certainly a plausible distinction.
And this is costing me money.
Which is that the case in Bava Basra is not really Hefker in the standard sense. It's not an object that has always been ownerless, and you're coming in to acquire it. It's an object that I tried to acquire, but owing to a legal loophole, I didn't succeed in acquiring. Right? So there are reasonable grounds for contending that this case is distinguishable. Okay, now he builds the whole argument off a linguistic diuk, and he tries to claim that the Rush and the Mordechai both agree with this position. And to get into this, he starts doing things that sound somewhat right. He starts doing academic analyses of why it is people cite positions, right? So he says that, well, if you cite both positions without poskening, it doesn't mean that you haven't poskened it. If you cite a position in one place, it doesn't prove anything because you could posken the other way in another place. Right? So it basically undermines much of the notion that you can derive psak from commentary. Because he doesn't think that people's citations are terribly meaningful.
Wasn't that something Marshall's famous for, though?
Is he famous?
I don't think he said this here.
No, I don't think this is made up for this truth.
Right.
I think that you see that he functions this way, right? That he's very academic. He comes up with very clear rules about how other people think, right? And that's part of his methodology.
He's very into there being machlokas sugyos, and so Rashi has like different things in different places, and that's just how it is.
Did anybody read Rosh today?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't. I think that there's a lot of room for. I think that many of his arguments are, to me, I have to say that by step three, I already thought he hadn't met the standard. Right, because I already thought, well, first of all, I have Rashi. And secondly, your arguments in Rashbam are maybe, but like absolutely? No, not absolutely. It takes time to figure out sometimes what the proof is because he's reading with such like hyper attention to detail in ways that are not terribly convincing.
But then he just says there's a point where he's just like, but it doesn't matter how Tosa writes it.
Yeah, so if we take a look, for example, right, so there's the part I called F, right? So that is.
Thank you for the
page number here, but I didn't get to label the the paragraphs. Okay, so right, so let's take a look where it says on page 5, the paragraph beginning "V'afsha divrei tospos," the perek loyachbor ksas eno mashmake. All right, so right, the whole point we're still in the effort to prove that the Rashbam in principle agrees with the Ben Yotam that you're not called a Rasha in a Hefker case. Just the Nichsei HaGoy HaRein Kemidbar case is different because there the Jew actually gave money and you're depriving him of something. By taking it, at which there is an easy response, so give him back the money, right? Then why should it be called a Rasha if you give him back the money, right? So it's not such a compelling case at all. But let's leave it at that. V'af shedivrei tosfot the perek lo yachbor ksas ino mashmakein shekasa v'zeh lashono. V'hadam rinam v'perek ches kasabatim Nichsei HaGoy HaRein Kemidbar v'chule. Upirish Rashbam, the Yisrael Hamachazik behen Rasha mihu mikri, ulefirish Rabbeinu Tam, afilu Rasha lohavi kaven shlo yimsa makam acher. Okay, so now first we have our first, right, this is the attempted rejection. Omeacher shekasav ulefirish Rabbeinu Tam, velo katav Rabbeinu Tam omer, kemosha didakti le'el belishad Rabbeinu Asher, mashma shetolo beplikta Rabbeinu Tam im Rashi perak omers, right, so he reads Tosas very technically. If you say ulefeirish Rabbeinu Tam, that means that you are extending an implication of Rabbeinu Tam. If you say Rabbeinu Tam omer, that means that you're citing Rabbeinu Tam directly on the case. And that was an argument he made earlier. So now he's being consistent. Right? So that must mean that here, the Rush is actually asserting that this is a machloket between Rabbeinu Tam and Rashbam. And right, and here now we have an issue. Right, he says, "Mashma shetolei beplikta Rabbeinu Tam im Rashi v'perek Omer." So the implication is that this is part of, because he began this by saying, "Well, inya mitzia itve plukta beni rivavasa." Right, so he connects this. Right, he quotes Machlokas Rashi on Rabbeinu Tam, and he seems to connect it directly to a previous citation of Machlokas Rabbeinu Tam in Rashi. And so now, that explains why he doesn't mention anything about Yesh's point that it's because he gave money here. He just quotes Rashbam as saying that you're not a Rasha here, because really the Rush seems to think that Rashbam holds like Rashi and against Rabbeinu Tam. Right? So now he's in trouble. Right? But this is built off the consistent claim that Ulefeirish Rabbeinu Tam means that there is a direct machloket here, and that the reason that the way in which you know that Rashbam isn't part of Rashi is because Rashbam gives a special rationale for the case of Bava Basra. Yes, yeah.
So basically, Tosfos being more Rabbeinu Tam than Rabbeinu Tam, they're extending his argument from Kedushin and applying it here, and maybe Rabbeinu Tam would have done that himself, maybe not.
Yeah, but we don't care about that. We're interested in Rashbam. Right.
But there's no Rashbam doesn't know that Rabbeinu Tam might disagree with him here.
Maybe they're brother or their brother, you know. Okay, he says Zeinu, don't think this. Ki atosus lo heviu sham das Rabbeinu Tam lipsak halacha. Right, when Tosus quoted Rabbeinu Tam there, they didn't intend to cite him as a source for psak. Kilomar shel perish Rabbeinu Tam yehab shach becheres cheskas abatim lo kerashbam. They didn't mean to say that Rabbeinu Tam was against Rashbam. Dim Kain, Hayal Alem Lechto, V'Hadam Rinam Beferik Cheskas Abatim Apirish Rashbam, Lifferish Rabbeinu Tam Lahavi Rasha, Ulifferish Rabbeinu Tam Mashma, She'eno Omed. Okay, so now we have a new diuk. If he said Lifferish Rabbeinu Tam, that would mean that he really thinks Rabbeinu Tam is a serious possibility. But as he says Ulifferish Rabbeinu Tam, he's just fighting Rabbeinu Tam in order to attack it. And if he's just fighting Rabbeinu Tam in order to attack it, so he has three different technical meanings in Tosfot, right? There's Rabbeinu Tam Omer, Pirish Rabbeinu Tam, and Lifferish Rabbeinu Tam, and Ulefeirish Rabbeinu Tam. And on the basis of that very precise terminology, he has decided that here Rabbeinu Tam is just being cited as the prelude to the next step. Okay, he says, since the Tosfos from Afrosh, Tosfos Loiviu Das Rashbam Rabbeinu Tam Elodayik Beim Elahakshos Lefarik Al Kenaviu Biksara Datam. So now that he's proven that the language of Ulefer Rabbeinu Tam means it's just a setup, so that means that Rashbam was also just a setup. And if Rashbam was also just a setup, then maybe he wasn't precise when he quoted Rashbam, And really, Rashbam holds like Rashi, but he just quoted it this way for the sake of argument.
Does this work? Can you do this consistently with this set?
Leferish as opposed to Uleferish?
Yeah, I don't know.
No. I mean, every manuscript will be different.
Does he know that?
I couldn't tell you.
Yes. He's one of the editors of the first printing.
He knows that it shifts, right? He is the editor of the Talmud to try, he tries to systematize. Right, he edits the Talmud to.
He can make it work if he wants it to.
Right. No, he'll tell you if manuscripts are right.
Great. So that means that he, by our standards, is making it up.
By our standards, this is probably not a very convincing argument.
I mean, I wonder if this argument has been made before, or if this is the only place that they've been diving the lesson.
I don't know.
We have computers now.
Is this brought down things like the Amalafi or whatever? I don't recall it.
I don't recall it in the Amalachi, but I didn't read the Kvali HaTosso terribly carefully. But I think that we'd have much more evidence than they had available anyway. We have many more versions of Tosfot. Yes, Josh.
So, can I go on a broader tangent now?
You can try. I may not follow you down.
Okay. My broader tangent is that a lot of the argumentation in the Smart Harshal, we might not find convincing.
Uh-huh.
And we don't actually know who, like, won this case. Like, we don't know what happened.
Uh-huh.
However, so many hundreds of years later, we've reached a point in time where Maharshal is one of the greatest Ahronim out there.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of his arguments in isolation might make sense, and we might want to use them.
Mm-hmm. That's true. How you use this tshuva is a fair question. As a precedent on any of the specific points, I don't know. And you have to figure out to what extent do you just summarize it as, well, the Marshal says, or do you feel like I really have to be convinced by these arguments? Because the truth is, many of these arguments are not going to be... And we're not talking about lumdas. We're talking about... Right, he's really just doing academic scholarship. Right? And they're not terribly convincing by contemporary academic standards, although they're quite brilliant, right, to think of them. Yes.
So, there's some, I'm not clear on this, but it seems like there are some claims here that are based on previous claims, and there are some that are
mm-hmm. Previous claims of whose?
Of his own. Meaning some of them build on each other, but not all of them. Like, if you took out this particular deus in the...
Well, that's what the whole of the structure is, right? He makes the claim just flat out on the basically Yeshu's point, right? That it's reasonable to say that Rashbam.
And that's a great argument, but so meaning we don't just because there are little things that we can be mifak picked, like it doesn't mean.
So the question is, right? Well, the structure of his argument is: I make this assertion. Here are the six things you could say to reject my assertion. Here are why the six things you could say to reject my assertion are wrong. Now, some of them, you might say that the argument to reject his assertion is no stronger than the argument he makes to reject the rejection of his assertion. And you're fine. Right? You know, they're all built on the same methodology, right? So if this question was built on the claim that you can distinguish between Rabbi Natan Omer and Pirush Rabbi Natan, right? So if you just don't like his technical terminology in Tosfos, so, okay, say, I don't accept your distinction between Perish and Leferish, but I didn't accept your distinction between Rabbi Natan Omer and Pirush in the first place. So the question never got started. But there are other places where the Rishonim, who seem to say really pretty clearly that Rabbi Natan and Rashbam disagree, and he goes out of his way to explain every single case where it seems that somebody might think that Rashbam and Rabbi Natan disagree, he says no, they really agree. Then he has the really fun proof he has at the end when he quotes Rabbi Peretz as claiming the reverse, that Rabbi Natan. That the position that he is trying to attribute to Rashbam is really Rabbi Natan's position. That Rabbi Natan is moded to Rashbam. And he says, well, we don't agree with him, but it shows you that somebody could hold that. Once you see that somebody could hold that, why can't I say it's Rabbi Natan instead of Rashbam? That's a very clever argument. Okay. Right, so that's really, the first stage is that Rashbam agrees as well. The problem is that, really, I think if we say it boldly, the problem is that every single Rishon seems to suggest the reverse, because all the Rishonim cite this as if it were one machloket. Right? No. Right? If this were true, you want a Rishon to say it. Right? Somebody should explain. And although there is a machloket Rashbam and Rabbi Natan here, it's not the same as the machloket there. Right? Because really Rashbam also agrees with Rashi. Instead, Rishonim spend their time trying to explain how Rashbam is compatible with other cases, right? With other cases where we don't call somebody a Rasha in a Hefker case. So I think actually prima facie it's a tremendously weak thesis.
It doesn't matter because we don't really need Rashbam.
So that's the question. I think he has to understand. Right? He's opening up with this, unless he's very, very bad at halachic rhetoric. So opening up with a weak argument is a bad idea. And he has to understand, with apologies to Yesh, that these are right, that although the argument in principle that Rashbam might hold this is reasonable, but the argument that the Rishonim thought he held that is really not so much, because no Rishon ever said this. And you'd think that'd be a really important thing to say, because most people just line up the machlokasim. And as you say, he has the language of the Rush, which says there's a machlokas among the rabbis about whether you become a Rusha in the case of Hefker and Metzia. And right after that, what does he do? And he says, right, he quotes this case, and he quotes Rashbam, and he quotes Rabbeinu Tam. Right? If he weren't making this argument, there's no way that you wouldn't think this is the same machlokas. Yes, Avi.
At least on one level, he thinks that he doesn't need a Rishon to say it. That's our standard. Our standard is you can't really make a new argument unless you have at least a Rishon who says it.
No, he's not making a new argument. He thinks he has a Rishon who says it. That's Rashbam. The question is whether the other Rishonim explaining that Rishon say it. And it's not that he needs... He knows he can make the argument. He needs all the other Rishonim to not say it. Mm-hmm. Right? Because if the other Rishonim interpret Rashbam differently, then for some reason he loses. Right? Then he's going against those Rishonim understanding of Rashbam. But not when you're trying to prove that somebody's Tovah is Bar Mishnah. Right, that's what I think. Yes, Elliot.
So this might be jumping a bit too much, but when I have I don't understand why he needs the Rashbam to give him the Tom when he has what at least I myself consider a stronger second argument about Nikah Rasha, right? Oh, so fine, Rashbam says in this case he Nikah Rasha. But there's nobody who holds that Nikah Rasha means you can, you know, punish the guy. And take away his license.
Okay, good. So that's the transition. So his next argument is that even if you, in it, that any case in which you call somebody a Rasha because they're like Ani Mahafik Bechara, any case which is called Ani Mahafik Bechara, that leads to Nikra Rasha, but not to a reversal of the transaction. Okay, and that's going to lead him to an argument where he's going to say, well, in terms of my client, A, the case is like Hefker, and everybody except Rashi agrees in the case which is like Hefker, you're not even called a Rasha. And B, even if you say the case is not like Hefker, or you hold like Rashi, you are called Nikra Rasha, but Nikra Rasha doesn't get you reversal, so my client still doesn't have to pay. All right, that's the way the argument is building. So now, Eliot's argument is, well, it should be sufficient to just say that Nikra Rasha never leads to reversal.
That deals also with the Rasha.
So let's start with just that. Tell me why that argument fails.
Because the last one makes it...
No. Tell me why it fails for the Maharshal. Just from stuff you know about the Maharshal. The Maharshal says that... We hold that in a case of Hefker, there's no... You're not called a Rasha, and this is a case of Hefker. Fine. B, he says, even if you hold like Rashi, that this case is, that you do say is a Rasha by Hefker, or if you say this is not a case of Hefker, so he's called a Rasha, but being called a Rasha does not lead to reversal. Does not mean that you have to pay. Okay? So now Eliot says, that argument should be enough. He should lead with that argument. Right? So what I'm saying is, there's a reason just what you know about Maharshal, that argument fails. Yes? It's in his distinction. What does he say? What's the halacha in the case of Nikra Rasha? No, what did he say?
The Rambam.
No! That he said the Rambam teaches you that...
You can use Deen to make him...
That you have complete discretion. And that, right, and that being called a Rasha is only a floor. That's in his own essay. Right? His own essay. Right? If you go back to reading what he says at the end of his essay, right, his second category is called Mahapik Becharora, and the outcome of Mahapik Becharora, he says, is it's called Nikra Rasha. And Nikra Rasha, he then says, but he has a problem because he can't justify the Rambam. So he says, the Rambam teaches you that Nikra Rasha is, right, is a floor, but judges always have the right to impose equity up to and including making you give the money back. So therefore, his second argument doesn't succeed by itself. It can't.
Why?
Because then the other judge could just say...
A judge?
The other judge, the judge who ruled previously.
An individual?
Yeah, the Dayan. The Dayan they went to previously.
An individual has the right to be not given one shalom and a din?
Yeah, that's how he reads the Rambam.
No, they're based in Ken.
I don't, right, the guy's functioning as a Beis Din.
Okay, that's part of the problem.
I think that's a very slender read for him to, right, if he end up saying, well, you know what, you could have done this, but because you're only one judge, you don't really have a Din Beis Din?
Of course.
All right, it'll work for you.
I think it's fair, though. I think the Rambam would agree that also, that you can't, that an individual does not have the right to impose financial penalties.
At all. That's already a knockout punch if you just disqualify him for being a Din.
Well, he did do that.
He tries that, but that's a, although that part doesn't survive in the version quote in the Am Shel Shlomo, right? It's only in the, right, it's in the Tshuva that he quotes that argument, I think.
It's not actually an appeals court.
Right, so I want to argue that that Elias' answer is correct, that he knows that argument won't work by itself, so he needs to make a stronger argument. And that's actually an underlying weakness all the way through. But I don't think, even that's not enough. I want more. Okay. So let's see what he does in this place of he said, well, how does he prove Ani Mahapech leads to Nikra Rasha, but not to a reversal of the transaction? So he has, right, so we are now, what page are we on?
Six.
We'll take the version that starts on page one. It's easier to keep track of the page numbers. There. All right, so on page six, right? So on page six, he starts off by making two arguments. So I say that are internal to the original case, right? One is which basically boil down to if the case of Anivah Becharora means you have to give the money back, then that meant that Rav Abba never really bought the land, and then he should give it back because it's not a bad siman to give it back. And even if it is a bad siman to give it to sell it again, but he's not selling it again when he gives it back. So either way, Rav Abba should have given the money back. Obviously, therefore, in the case of Rav Gidl and Rav Abba, it is not right. The result of being Nikra Rasha is not reversibility. But those cases are reasonably distinguishable prima facie on the grounds that the whole point is that Rav Abba didn't know Rav Gidl was being mahapech. So right, and he's not a Rasha. The question in that case is, what happens if you do something that, if you did it deliberately, would make you call the Russia? And it turns out you did it accidentally, what are you supposed to do now? So in such cases, certainly it isn't halakhically reversible, and so I think his argument doesn't work. Yes?
I mean, I didn't get this far inside, so I don't know about the argument, but why does he have to say that this isn't the case in the Russia? Yep. Like, why can't... Isn't there a stronger to say this is the case of Nikra Rasha? He doesn't have to give it back.
Well, that was Elias' claim, and my point was that he can't do that because if he actually read his...
In just sort of Gidel and Rav Abba case, right? He doesn't have to claim that it's...
He doesn't. No, he claims that it is a case of Nikra Rasha, and the fact that they don't give it back proves that you don't have to.
Okay.
Right? I'm saying is that actually, if you read the Sugya, it's not a case of Nikra Rasha, and that's why they didn't have to give it back, and since his argument, his proof...
Is your reading necessarily more plausible?
Necessarily, read the sugya, right? He walks up to him and says, "Ani Mahapech Becharora, what are you supposed to do?" And he says, "Nikra Rasha." So what about you? Well, I didn't know. So obviously he held because I didn't know, right? I'm not.
No, I don't know. It could be like, or it could be exactly this: that Nikra Rasha, it doesn't mean you have to give it back. He is Nikra Rasha, he doesn't have to give it back.
Right. So they're both plausible, right? But if he wants a proof, it's not a proof. Because I have an alternate reading. I'm not saying his reading is implausible, but it's not a proof.
Okay.
Now, what I want to take a look at is the section where I called B1, right? Is that it? So let's find out where we are.
With B, I...
4B. Yeah, so let's start with 4B.
4BI1.
Let's start with 4B. Where's 4B? Top of 7. Okay. So right. So our goal here is to prove that ane mahapik becharara is not does not lead to reversing the transaction. So haran kasa perches kasa batim. V'he'elu achronim zichronim levarachad b'makom. No, zelashonim. No, achronim zelashonim b'makom shnei kurasha. Mikol makom ein mechayiv no so bezin lachazir. Midamrina b'perek homer b'kedushin. Zavuni lo mizavnina, right? So that's our case, right? So people tried to prove from the case of Gidlon Rabbi Abba that it's not reversible. And now the Ran writes this unfortunate thing. Shelo kudivir rabbeinu tam, shapira shemechayiv moto lachazir. Okay, so now we're in trouble because what's the whole argument? What's his whole argument in the first case built on, right? His first stage of his argument is he's going to, right, his client is going to win. Why? Because we paskin like Rabbeinu Tam. But now the second stage of his argument is against the Beferish Rabbeinu Tam. Right, that's not good.
Why?
You don't like paskin like Rabbeinu Tam, particularly since he has a suspicion, as do I, that somehow all these positions of Rabbeinu Tam are connected. Right, he has this.
Was Ran the only one who quoted this position of Rabbeinu Tam? I can't remember.
Oh, so the only one, at least he's the only one that he knows of, quoting this position of Rabbeinu Tam. When we go back and evaluate, we shall have to go and see whether we are, whether the strength of his argument depends on the Ran being the only person who quotes Rabbeinu Tam, because if we have seen other people, which I believe we have, who quote this position of Rabbeinu Tam, we have to figure out maybe they got it from a common source. Maybe the common source is the same error. But here we go to town.
We saw it in the Ramban and Rashi,
which is earlier than the Ran.
But the Ran.
So the Ran is really
more people saw the Ran.
Right.
Than
so we're seeing consistently, right, that he doesn't have access, right, like the Beis Yosef, he doesn't have access to Ramban in the original. But if it's in the Ramban, that's harder to claim that it's an error. Yes.
Just to go back to the actual case. The license is Hefker.
The
license is Hefker.
We haven't gotten to how he's going to do that yet.
Okay, because
he's going to make the license Hefker. All right, that's going to be the right after he goes to the vast bulk of the Tshuva is designed to set up these theoretical arguments, and then what we're going to see is to get from the theoretical argument to his case. Right, then there are a lot of times when you have to write really, really complicated rapid equations on the board, which may or may not be the equivalent of then a miracle occurs.
It just seems like the more steps he puts into his proof, the more possibilities you have to disprove it.
Yeah, so that is a sensibility issue, right? That there are some people, right, who look at an argument and they say that argument is too complex, and you just look at it and say, well, okay, let's suppose that each of these six, I sometimes do this, and this is a challenge. You just made a 60-step literary argument. Each of your steps has a 90% probability of being true. If any one of the steps is false, the argument is false. What are the odds? Minimal.
That's the position he's in, right? I mean, if this were a different case, if he wasn't trying to disprove someone who'd already made a case, then he could make his six arguments, have a chance of 90% of them being true, and as long as one of them is right, he's right.
No, but I'm talking about a step argument. You have a 60, right? You have a very complicated argument that says, if this is true, then this is true, if this is true, then this is true. So that's a sensibility thing that sometimes from moderns, we look at it and we say, what are the chances that each of them get up? But there is a very reasonable halachic sensibility which says that's not how we think about it. We say, after the first step, it was 90% chance, so that's rove, and it's true. Now we go to the second step. Second step, 90% chance, that's rove, so it's true. And at the end, the odds end up being 100% that it's true.
No, but I think that, people are laughing, but you have to,
otherwise
we're going to get past.
Otherwise, the problem is that no serious halakhic argument will ever have a more than 10% chance of being true.
Right. No, I just wonder, isn't that how we have
right, so you need, right, so you need that kind of sensibility, and the question is at what point you can suspend your statistical disbelief. Right? What kind of arguments look to you like they follow the rules, so you're willing to accept them
before
that way?
Before that, he seems to make a claim, he seems to complicate, and then have to solve the complication that he just created.
You mean the whole framework of raising the objection and then opposing it, you'd be better off not raising it?
No, it seems that there are real objections to his claims, but in order to solve each objection, he makes it endlessly complicated, and he has to solve the complications he's just made. And it seems like...
Because you think, right, and again, that's a sensibility issue. You find these arguments unconvincing because they are long and involved. But if you...
No, it's just that he's creating his own problems.
Because, first of all, you don't think of those problems spontaneously, right? It's not obvious to you what the problems are. right? So, right, but he might culturally think it's, you know, that if he ignores it, everyone will jump down his back, right? You're an idiot, you're right? It's obvious what the problems are.
Okay.
And secondly, if you live in a culture where this is the form of argument, so he's just making a perfectly normal argument. You know, this is not complex relative to, say, Rav Akiva Eger or the Chiddushei Arim, right? You know, Rav Akiva Eger can make, you know, 30-page arguments, each of which goes step by step by step by step by step, and if you did the statistical logic, it could be each of them could be 99.9% true, and he still wouldn't have a good chance. But the rules of halakhic argumentation were that if you made the best argument of that type, then you win, because that's all we can do is make the best argument of that type. Okay. Yeah.
Is it possible that people attribute Rabbi Yonatan Jesus to Rabbi Yonatan incorrectly? I vaguely recall learning or reading somewhere that, like...
Oh, yes. So that's exactly what he's going to say. Right? He's going to say, right, because he is, right, he is an early academic, and he doesn't see any reason to believe that things attributed to Rabbi Yonatan are actually Rabbi Yonatan. Right? His whole, right, again, you know, part of his, right, he didn't want anyone to actually say that Rashbam said the thing he doesn't want Rashbam to say. He's stuck. Right? He just, what he did last section was say, and somebody has Rabbi Yonatan say the thing he wants Rashbam to say. So he uses that to prove that the argument is plausible, even though he rejects the attribution to Rabbeinu Tam.
The question really is, which one is the real Rabbeinu Tam?
Yes, and so we're going to see he just rejected the Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz's description, right, citation of Rabbeinu Tam, and now he's about to reject the Ran citation of Rabbeinu Tam, right? Because he's going to, you know, come in. Rabbeinu Tam is only the Rabbeinu Tams that are cited by Tosfot and the Rush. Right? Those are the only Rabbeinu Tams that he's interested in, only the way he understands them. I don't know. I don't know why you would believe them over the Marshal. Right. So I don't like the titles bias, and Rabbeinu Tam because we don't have anything from Rabbeinu Tam himself. All right. So how would we know?
Pardon? That's the trump card, right? The Sefer
Yasher isn't really Rabbeinu Tam either. It's also just students writing down reports of his stuff. We don't have any actual work of Rabbeinu Tam.
Doesn't he say he wrote down the Sefer Yasher?
Yes, but what we have is not it.
We have parts of it, no?
Yeah, but which parts of it are the parts of it? I wouldn't. I am, in a sense, I have the luxury of having, you know, the danger of a little bit of knowledge, right? So I know the things that are wrong about academics without being able to do this kind of scholarship myself. I never quite got over the image of Dr. Salvation describing one particular scholar sitting in the library and writing every single version down on index cards and then always picking the wrong one. I'm not going to say, but...
The wrong
text to serve as the base text to, right, to build your edition around.
Finkelstein?
I'm not going to say. Not someone you would think of.
Finkelstein?
This isn't the game.
Okay. You're always worried about being that person. I remember, like, Professor Shalom telling us that he sat in the Merkaz Beit Midrash, listening to a chavrusa next to him learn Maral and get every single line wrong. And that's scary, but I had a similar experience. Professor Shalom convinced me that I can't read Maral either, but I sat in the Beit Midrash listening to somebody teach Maral, and yeah. But whatever it meant, it wasn't that. So you don't want to be that person. Okay. For the record, if you're teaching Maral, the word Ila means cause, not elevation. If you get that wrong, you're in a lot of trouble.
Wait, so now I have to ask, did you call him out?
No. No, I did not call it out.
Ila Teilut is highest in the high.
All right. Not sure I knew that then, but I realized later. I was sitting next door. I wasn't part of the shiur. I was just sort of being amazed at somebody having the courage to teach Maral, because I had learned that, you know, that it was. I learned in the class with Professor Shalom that Maral was well beyond me. So it was very courageous for someone to teach Maral, and
courageous.
Sometimes courage is not rewarded. Okay. We could say fools rush in where angels fear to tread, but that itself is a satirical line.
Fool's Rush in Angel's Pure to Tread is in The Rape of the Lock, and it's talking about somebody sneaking up behind his girlfriend and cutting, and with scissors to cut a lock of her hair. Anyway. Okay, so we got, right, so let's back to the run. Okay, we have the Achronim. Shalom k'divrei b'netam shepirish mechayvim oto lachzor. V'tama aniyim yatzadavar zem yipir b'netam zal. I'm astonished. Could Rabbi Netam really have said something like this? Sh'ilmole nishtakfa Torah Yisrael hechazira b'pilpulo. Rabbi Netam, if we had forgotten everything Moshe Rabbeinu taught us, Rabbi Netam could have put it back together. V'yishke b'zed, he would make a mistake this dumb? No, Rabbi Netam could never have said anything this dumb. So the Ran's report must be wrong. The Gamanilo Matsasi Remez Bechol Haposkim Shum Tzad Havamina Lachzor Hamekach Elul Kros Russia. I have never found any hint in any of the poskim, even the suggestion that you might have thought that somebody would have that somebody would think that you could return it rather than calling Russia. V'chein Pasek Marik Sof Simen Kuflam Bet Pipshitus V'Diek Midivrei Rashbam. Okay, Aram Paskin this, and he derived it from Rashbam. Because Rabban Pashapasak Gabi Nifsi Hagoyesh Nikra Russia, right, the Rashbam said that in the case in Bava Basra that you're called a Russia, the Ihave Pirusho, Shitzarech Lachazir Loha Karka, and if the meaning of Rashbam, when he says you're called a Russia, is that in that case you have to return the land to the non Jewish buyer, the Mainach Gemina Amar Shmuel Hamachazik Vazacha Adkan. Okay, so the Marik said that according to the Rashbam, where he's called a Russia, it can't mean that being called a Russia means you have to undo the transaction, because the halacha there is, right, Amar Rabbi Amar Shmuel, Nitzeh Agoy Harehen Kemidbar, Kol HaMachazik Behem Zacha. And what would be the point of saying that he's Zacha if he has to return it? That's Marik's argument. So Marik derives this from Rashbam.
Wait, sorry, I need to do that one more time.
Again, so Rashbam, said, the Gemara says, Rav Huda says the name of Shmuel, the land of a non-Jew in this peculiar case, right, where you gave the money and he hasn't yet given you the shtar, is like a midbar, which means kol hamachzik b'hem zacha. Anybody, whoever gets there first wins. So the Marik says, and the Rashbam says he's called a Russia, even so. So the Marik says, well, if being called a Russia meant you have to return it, what sense does it make for the Gemara to write the halacha kol hamachzik b'hem zacha? You're zacha for 5 minutes, then you have to return it. So therefore, the Marik proved from this, right? That the Rashbam held that Nikra Russia doesn't mean that it's right, they have to reverse the transaction.
For Rashbam.
The Athel Pish Ein Raya Gemura Rakal Das Rashbam. So even though I have no proof from here, all I can prove from here is the opinion of Rashbam, I haven't proven anything about Rabbeinu Tam. And my goal is to prove something about Rabbeinu Tam. Pardon? Pardon. Aval. The Olam Rabbi Natan Latame, Shesavar Hasam, Delo Nikra Russia, Lahachi Amar Shmuel Machazik Zacha. Aval the Olam, Hecha Nikra Russia, Kofinus Aliver Tam Lachzor, Ella Machvarta Haraya Kidifirashti. Okay, so who understood those lines? Let's try it again. Right, he says, the Afalpi Shein Raya Gemura, Rakal Das Rashbam. So even though there is no proof here, except about Rashbam, but Rabbeinu Tam could hold according to his own reasoning, because Rabbeinu Tam will hold in that case that he's not called a Russia at all. So since Rabbeinu Tam holds in that case that he's not called a Russia at all, so therefore you cannot prove from Kol HaMachzik B'Zacha, you cannot prove that Rabbeinu Tam thinks that Nikra Russia doesn't mean you reverse the transaction, because Rabbeinu Tam, that's not a case of Nikra Russia. So all we have left. So, pardon?
Couldn't he have said that at the beginning?
He's not done yet. Right. He starts off by saying, right, his initial thesis is that nobody thinks Nikra Russia means you reverse the transaction. The problem is Rabbeinu Tam says Nikra Russia, right? Rabbeinu Tam says Nikra Russia means you reverse the transaction.
Right.
So he says, no, Rabbeinu Tam never said that.
Right.
Now he wants to prove Rabbeinu Tam never said that. So he says, well, I can't prove Rabbeinu Tam never said that. What I can prove is that Rashbam wouldn't have said that.
And that Rabbeinu Tam didn't think it was Nikra Russia in the first place.
And there's no proof of Rabbeinu Tam in that case. Rabbeinu Tam didn't think it was Nikra Russia. So the proof doesn't work for Rabbeinu Tam. It only works for Rashbam. Yes, Elliot.
So we established earlier that Rashbam and Rabbeinu Tam.
Ah, so this is where I think it's right.
So I think that the reason he goes to so much effort in the beginning to say that Rashbam agrees with Rabbeinu Tam is because that will enable him here to make the argument that what he says about Rashbam is also true for Rabbeinu Tam. I think that's what the giant structure of the argument is. Okay, right. I think that is the right. And so the rest of this is to prove, right? The rest of this argument is where he goes out of his way to prove that you can prove this for Rashbam. There's actually going to be a point where he tries to claim that this is true of Rabbeinu Tam as well, right? So that's where we get now we're going to get even more complicated to try and prove that this is reasonable to derive Rabbeinu Tam's position, or at least to derive the Rabbeinu Tam doesn't disagree with Rashbam about this. Okay, so he says, "Aval ein lomar, afilu miksas raya eno." But don't tell me, right? Don't tell me that this doesn't even apply to Rashbam. The afilu the kedivir Rashbam shadis benarga velomar dilma dafka bina nixei agoy shein kehefker. I mean, din afilu rasha lohay krasa l'shein lamaksik b'akadash Rabbeinu Tam. So now he says, let's figure this out. So Rashbam thinks. You might think that Rashbam says that in the case of Nechsi HaGoy, he really shouldn't be a Rasha because it's a case of Hefker. Why does Rashbam think you're called a Rasha anyway?
Because he paid.
But maybe Rashbam will say that because this is not the usual case of Anibapech Becharara, it's a special exception to the rule that there's no Anibapech Becharara by... because of the money, maybe this Nikra Rasha is weaker than the other Nikra Rashas. Don't think that. Because Rashbam says that this case is lo gora me'ani mehapik b'charara. It's not worse than ani mehapik b'charara. It's not less likely to be called Rasha than ani mehapik b'charara. Rashbam says this. And therefore, Rashbam must think it's at least equal to the standard case of ani mehapik b'charara. Fine.
Is it really half minute to say that there's a weaker and stronger Nikra Rasha?
Yeah, because in the end, that's actually how he paskins. Right? In the end, he says you can do whatever you want. right? In the end, he has, in his whole categorization, right, he thinks that Nikra Rasha is different than Gazal Midivrehim. And neither are reversible. So he's into different levels of moral opprobrium.
I still can't find a good definition.
Sorry. Okay. So now he has what I think is the core argument about this. He says, "Aval ein lomar, don't say." We're still in the next paragraph, still on page 7.
Okay, but we're still in this.
We're still right. This is going to be another objection. This is going to be another claim that really Rabbeinu Tam does think that in Nikra Rasha we reverse the transaction. Right. So don't say this. Right. And this is going to be an argument that Rabbeinu Tam really thinks that, and then he's going to explain why you shouldn't say that because Rabbeinu Tam really doesn't think that,
okay.
And the Ran made a mistake. Okay, it says Ein Lomar to the Vada Rabbeinu Tam b'siyata sovereign shakofin oso lachzor to ilav hachi because Rabbeinu Tam did not think that the transaction could be reversed. My parech beferek omer demasnis in above mesia ro es hamesia v'nafal leo v'achar v'natla harehi shelo. Right, from which Rabbeinu Tam derives alma de lo mikri rasha benichse hefker mesia. Okay, so Rabbeinu Tam's the way he understands Rabbeinu Tam's logic. Rabbeinu Tam thinks like this. Rabbeinu Tam says, by Kiddushin, in the case of Ani Mahapech Becharara, he's called a Rasha. But in the case of Metziah, where you fall in Metziah, you're not called a Rasha. Rabbeinu Tam says, this is a Stira. Why aren't you called a Rasha above Metziah if you're called a Rasha in Kiddushin? Rabbeinu Tam's solution is that the case in Kiddushin is talking about a case of Mecher and Schirus, and the case in Metziah is talking about a case of Hefker, and that's how Rabbeinu Tam derives that in the case of Hefker, you're not called a Rasha. But he says, hang on a second. Right, he says the Gemara, so Rabbeinu Tam raises, sorry, am I getting this right? So Makasha, so what is Rabbeinu Tam's question? If it turns out that even in Kiddushin, you don't reverse the transaction according to Rabbeinu Tam, which is what he's claiming, right? He's claiming that in the standard case of Ani Mahapech Becharara, you're just called a Rasha, but you don't give back the money according to Rabbeinu Tam. Dilmali Ola Mikri Rasha, right? Maybe all the Gemara in Bava Metziah means when he says Harei Shelo, it means you don't have to give it back. And the Gemara above, and the Gemara above Metzia, the Mishnah above Metzia, isn't telling you anything about whether he's a Rasha. It's just telling you the Halacha. The Halacha is it's yours. Right? So if you think that whenever you nicker Rasha, you have to give it back, so then the case above Metzia is a proof that you're not called a Rasha. But if you think all nicker Rasha means is you're a bad person, but you get to keep it, so there's no contradiction with the Gemara that says you get to keep it. So therefore, Rabbi Tam's proof depends on the assertion that Nikra Rasha means you have to give it back. Okay?
You want to say that again?
Yes. So his argument is as follows. He says, right, again, this is wrong. Right? You understand, right? This is the argument he thinks you shouldn't make. Right? The argument you shouldn't make is as follows. Rabbi Tam derives his position that you're not called a Rasha in a case of Hefker by posing a contradiction between the case of Ani Mahapech Becharara, where you are called a Rasha, and the case of Metzia, where you're not called a Rasha. In the case of Metzia, it says, Harehi Shalo, you get to keep it. Rabbi Tam says, well, how could you get to keep it if in Kedushin it says, Renikra Rasha? So the Marshal says, what's the problem? Even though you're called a Rasha, you get to keep it. So Rabbi Tam's question doesn't get started. Okay, that's his problem. So now he has to explain why no. Rabbi Tam actually is making a very good argument. Okay, so to get this argument, so to reject this argument, he says, right, so this is Ze'eno, right? All this is wrong. Really, everybody agrees that Ani Mahapech Becharara gets you called a Rasha, but it's not reversible. The Elo Dayek Rabbeinu Tam Ela Mishum Din Rasha Hu Shiachzer HaMekach. Because if you're going to claim that Rabbeinu Tam's argument is all built on the claim that if you're called a Rasha, you have to return it, Im Kain Eich Matzu Maram VaMordechai Yedeim VeRagleihem SheMaskim LeDas Rashbam Kedepi Rashti. The Gam Kain Savri Kedivri Rabbeinu Tam She'ein Shayach Din Mahapech Becharara B'Metzia VeHefker Kedepricious. Okay, so here's his argument. He says, if Rabbeinu Tam's whole argument is built on this, then it should not be possible for people to A, hold like Rabbeinu Tam, and B, hold like Rashbam, who says explicitly that you're not right, you don't reverse the transaction. If Rabbeinu Tam's whole position by Hefker is dependent on his position that you have to that Nikra Rasha means you reverse the transaction, then it should not be possible for people to hold both positions simultaneously. A, you're not called a Rasha by Hefker, and B, that if you're called a Rasha, the transaction is reversible. So the existence of people, namely the Maram and the Mordechai, who hold against Rabbeinu Tam on this issue, but nonetheless like Rabbeinu Tam on the Hefker issue, proves that that this argument is wrong. This issue is whether it's reversible. Right? There are two issues, reversibility and Hefker. So the kasha is, aren't those two positions intertwined? Because the only way to derive the position about Hefker is on the basis of the reversibility position. And the answer is no, they can't be intertwined because there are people who hold both positions together. So his solution is that you're right. Rabbeinu Tam couldn't derive his position, but from the, because actually at this point, what he's just proven is not, he hasn't come up with a substantive argument. He's just said, your argument can't be right because the existence of people who hold what you say is a contradiction proves it's not a contradiction. He hasn't explained why it's not a contradiction. So his solution is that Rabbeinu Tam actually brings two proofs. One is the proof from Bav Metzia where it says, Harei Hein Shelo. And the other proof is from the Mishnah in Peah, where it says Ma'avirin Osohimena, and Ma'avirin Osohimena he thinks means explicitly, and you're not a Rasha. Ma'avirin Osohimena means we take it away from the first guy and give it to the second guy, so obviously the second guy is not a Rasha. So Peah, right? So he says Rabbeinu Tam could derive his position without any reference to the Gemara above Messiah.
just by posing the contradiction between Kedushin and Peah. Right? The argument of Rabbeinu Tam says, look, by Kedushin, it says you're called a Rasha. If you take some, right, by Peah, it says that, good for you. Resolution is, Peah is talking about Hefker, and Kedushin is talking about Mecher. And that argument works. The only problem is, the old Tosfot cite Rabbeinu Tam proving it from both places. And the argument doesn't work in the first place. So this doesn't work in Tosfot. Yes?
You have to insert into Peah that he's not a Rasha, which is not explicit.
That's not explicit. You have to read Ma'avir no Sohemena. Right? Meaning we take it.
The whole thing falls apart.
Yes.
Because it's exactly the same case.
Yes, now we can build the whole argument, right? Because it's.
But that's where he said Lechatchila, and if it's Lechatchila, you wouldn't do something Lechatchila that would make him somebody
yes.
Rasha.
Yes. Right? So his argument is that. Rabbeinu Tam's argument doesn't work in the case of Bav Metzia, but it does work in the case of Peah if you assume that Ma'avir no Sohemena means that he's not called a Rasha. So that raises the problem, so why does Tosfot claim that Rabbeinu Tam proves it from both Bav Metzia and Peah? And here we go in academic again, we say, oh, you know what, Rabbeinu Tam, really, the real proof is from Peah, and they just threw in Bav Metzia because it looked because it looked very similar. And then he says, uh-oh, but there are places where Rabbeinu Tam quotes the argument from Bav Metzia first and the argument in Peah second. Well, you know what? The order in Tosfot doesn't make any difference. And that's where we are.
But vid kibitar does make a difference.
That is the formal argument. Okay. Then if we go on to D, which is the Rokeach, which is the other thing that the other person cited, the argument cited by Dayan X was the Rokeach. So let's take a look what he does with the Rokeach, which I think is on page 9. So page 9, the second paragraph on the page, he says that. This is D. It says Mehay Tshuva Shel Rokeach Le'el Ein Lavi Raya Shetzarich Lachzor. Even though from the language of the Rokeach that he cited earlier, you can't bring any proof that he has to be Machzor. Now you remember the Rokeach. If you turn back, we don't have right. Rokeach said you get put in Cherem until you undo it. So it sounds very much like it. Shekasev Bavim Lo Yishma LeKol Horeo Kemoshe Vesi Le'el Betana Leda Samore Ze'Einel. Deha, what's right? Pshita upshita. Da rokeach lo airi elo bedavar shabal yado kvar. The kana osa bikinyan gomor belichisaron shum davar lagmaras hamekach. Okay, so what he does now is that the rokeach, when he says that if you're masig gvul, right, we reverse the transaction, he's talking about real hasagas gvul, not our stuff. Now the problem is there is no case of real hasagas gvul in the Gemara, right? But he says that he creates this category called real hasagas gvul, and that's what the Rokeach is responding to. And the Rokeach never meant to say that in our case, even if it's right quasi hasagas gvul, that we would reverse the transaction.
Is this a legal fiction?
A legal fiction. It's a case that, so he invents a case of Hasagas Gvul where, right, he says the standard of Hasagas Gvul is where the first person has already been Kona it Bikinyan Gomer with absolutely nothing lacking, but somebody went to the government and had the government annul the prior transaction which had already been completed. So it's not Gezel because, right, that's his case. It's not Gezel because you don't take the object from the other person. What you do is you get the government to take the object from the other person. So that's what he thinks is real Hasagas Gvul. So we would have a whole debate. The other truth is a Grama ben Azikin, a thing like that. But that's what he thinks is the only real case of Hasagas Gvul. Okay. Now he says, V'ein Lomar, and that's where he gets into the point that Elliot raised earlier. He says, V'ein Lomar, the Dilma Harokeach Bik Amatza V'Gadar, maybe the Rokeach discovered that, oh my goodness, people are being masig gvul in these lesser ways, and our calling them a Rasha isn't stopping them.
So maybe the Rokeach made a new gzera that we should reverse the transaction, a transaction of this sort. Kasher kasav harambam, afel pish ein dun and dineknosis onus mafate, the lamachel ev gzel sachavos, mikal makom lemigdar milsa, konsin abetin lefitikun shav et tara chazman. So maybe what the Mora learned from the Rokeach was that we use our extra legal powers in the judiciary to enforce this din, and then that will be used against his client as well. Ze'enu. Why? Because the Rokeach said that if you're Masik Vul, you're Nikra Gazlan, you're Nikra Russia, Ve'en Gazlan Kamosu. Mashmed din Gazlan Mamash Yeshalov. So Rokeach must be talking about a case where it's real Gzela. He wasn't just using rhetoric. But in case you don't Joe shake your heads, because it says even kids understand this, right? Kalvachomer adults understand this argument. If you don't get it, right, you're not in the parsha.
Why do you have to go that far? Why can't you just say it's rhetoric and that was fine for him and we're not
because he has to make the other person toe of his var mishnah.
He's toe of var mishnah, assuming that ignoring time is
okay. What?
Ignoring the rokeach time, meaning the rokeach making a rasha. You're possibly going to Rosh Hashanah.
The Rokeach says that you reverse the transaction.
Right. In this one case, because he found a Makom Liskaderbo.
No, he's assuming that if the Rokeach could do that in this kind of in a case of a Sagas Vul, which is just like this one, so then the original Mora could say, I am following, which, and then what did the original Mora do? He quoted the Rokeach at him.
It's a bad quote.
Why not? Why is it a bad quote?
Because you lose the context.
You lose the context.
Think of context. Rokeach had a city. This was a common problem in the city, and Rokeach had to put it in. Step
it out. You don't think this is a common problem in his city?
I don't know.
Not so convinced.
Hey, either way, if he said it was a common problem, would that be just a problem with Shabbat, not necessarily a problem with Mishnah? As soon as he assesses the reality
I don't think. I don't think it would work. Okay, and then he assumes that right that lahachriz alav rabim is not the equivalent of reversing the transaction, and at the end of the day, he says that by the way nowadays, right? There used to be a machlokes about marufia, but nowadays there's no marufia, and so obviously we're not right. We can't reverse it nowadays, right? So that's a really big move. That's what he does on page 11. Is that where it is? Yeah, so let's read the top of page 11. Right, it says, Me'achar di'esh mekomat chalukos, v'esh panim l'kan l'kan, roi l'chadchila l'esor lav, avol lo dun olav klal bifrat bizmanim eilu. Right, so this is machlokas, right, some places are done din marufia, some places are not, so you can tell people you shouldn't do it, but you can never go to court about it. V'chein matzasi shepasak av bezin azakim arinu v'rabbeinu rabbi kolonimus, asher kvod menuchasu l'esata b'chal kal kadosh brisk, the Shabbos Tach Kamuni, the Chol Bali Trace, and the positive sign of Shamu Eskimo, Zel Shonagon, the Glilos Halalu, the Masana Yudena Raglena Leosan, Leosena Dunin Bedene Marufia. Okay, and he says in the end, everybody there is only arguing about whether it's similar to Dagim or not, but everyone agrees, Anim Mahavek Becharora, you can't judge at all. Okay, this is the overwhelming bulk of the Tshuva, is making. That right is making these two arguments. One is that we paskin like Rabbeinu Tam. Even the Rashbam in principle agrees with Rabbeinu Tam and just thinks the case for Yahweh Zuzeh is different. Now you're going to tell me, hang on, that doesn't help at all because here the first guy did pay the money. So how does this help his client?
We didn't pay the money for the second.
Yeah. So now we're right. So this is where right. So now we pull out the fireworks. Now that he's gotten his legal basis, so now he has to deal with this case. So he makes a number of claims. Claim number one that. Ani Mahapech only applies if you intercede by yourself, but not if the seller told you, if the seller approached you. Right? Let's take Rabbeinu Tam's case, right? There's an Ani trying to walk around hang around the house hoping that the rich guy will hire you to drive him. And while he's walking around the house, the rich guy calls you on the phone and says, "So, Jenna, do you have a summer job?"
Do I?
All right, so he called you. So now you can go compete with Avi.
Wait, does he get that from anywhere?
No.
Like, he's just making that up.
Yes.
I think, I mean, like, talk about, like, Bittul Torah and Anima HaPikva Torah, like, the, I mean, like, that's the case that's most likely to come up, right, is when there's a buyer who's shopping for...
Yes. On the other hand, it's perfectly reasonable, right, the, right to say that if the other guy's still shopping around, so obviously he hasn't reached
he's
a conclusion.
Committed.
Right?
It's in the
Lashon,
too, right?
Uvach HaRinat Lo. Yeah, but what doesn't fit in the case in the Lashon is that it's serious. Right, what fits in the Lashon is that there's a cake running down the street and there's somebody chasing after it. Right, so right, so you know, what fits in the Lashon according to Rabbeinu Tam, right, is a the child you know should, yes.
Well, I mean, the thing to remember is that in that case, as soon as you get this theorist, one of the in halacha is that you're more likely to have liability towards your competitor, right, to the other end or whatever, than you are, than the because halacha has a hard time enforcing the forward-looking contract rights between the two people who agree.
Yes.
Right. So that's why the schiris, the whole interjection of schiris into that just makes it a very difficult subject. And I think your question points to that, right? Because you say, well, what if you said I'll hire you, right, to drive me around? And I say, you come on to schiris Yisrael with an algor or some kind of.
Yeah. So that's the whole right set. At what point? If you think that the standard...
If there's no liability
yeah.
between the two parties who allegedly yeah. have a contract, to find liability to a third party trying to...
Okay, I will translate those who have not been inside our conversation previously. Right. What Professor Sam is pointing out is that we're dealing with cases where right, we're saying is that if I come... Right, Jenna comes in and tries to entice Richie Rich to hire her instead of Avi. So Jenna's done something wrong. But if Richie Rich decides to hire Jenna, he hasn't done anything wrong. Right? So why is it in Rabbeinu Tam's case that we blame Jenna for trying to come between Avi and Richie Rich? Why don't we just say Richie Rich has an obligation to hire Avi once we started the conversation? But nobody suggests that.
Well, because you don't have jurisdiction over the...
Why not? I could say the halacha is that once you enter into a conversation, at a
but
certain
a
point...
Non-Jew.
Right? He's not a non-Jew, so he's a Jew. We don't have the non-Jews here. Right, so it's an ironic thing is where we are holding you responsible for interfering with a contractual relationship which we don't recognize. Right, so that's the point Professor Simon makes, which is a very good point. Right? It's a very odd thing to say that we blame you for competing, even though the other person is perfectly at liberty to accept your competition. So to some extent, Rabbeinu Tam, right, this is where it's trying to say, well, that doesn't, right, exactly because the Marik is trying to say, that doesn't make any sense. Right? To say that you interject yourself, okay, so that, but to say that the other guy calls you, and he's perfectly in his rights to call you, but you have to say no.
I don't think that, I don't agree with your, I don't think I agree with you, because I think that otherwise you're not limiting competition, you're limiting, like, infringing on other people's contracts, but I think a lot of what we've been talking about is that there's a value in actually limiting competition, which assumes that the people who are shopping are going to be going so wherever.
So you think it's just a reasonable regulatory decision to limit the merchants and not the shoppers?
I don't think there's a lack of precedence for putting the burden on.
Okay.
The
okay, fair. Yes, Ellie.
Two things. First of all, Pasha Takaros Leichlim, but that's a very glib response. The other response is that there's a difference between limiting competition and limiting the prerogative or the autonomy of the consumer base.
Yeah, so that's what Jenna's saying, right? You know, you're entitled to try to save money, but I'm not allowed to sell it too cheap.
Right. I mean, right. The second person, Jenna, she wasn't volunteered. She was brought in by the Richie Rich.
Well, that's what the Marik says. Marik says that, you know, even though there's no precedent saying this, it just makes sense to him, especially in Rabbeinu Tam, to say that it can't be that you have to say right. It can't be that you have to say no when the other guy approaches you, because that's just a silly system. It's inefficient for everyone. If the other person is going to spend time approaching you and you have to say no, why don't we just tell him, don't approach you? And he should know he can't approach you. No, let's not go there. Okay. Okay, that's his first claim. Now this, right, but then he has to have a fancier argument because the question is not only, is this true? The question is, do we believe you when we say the other guy approached you? Because it's very hard to know who called whom first. Right, so then he has a lot of fun arguing that you can be believed, and that his client doesn't even have to take a shvuah, because he might reasonably think his client has to take a shvuah. No,
client doesn't even have to take a shvua. We just believe him. The other guy approached him, but he has all sorts of challenging arguments to follow about why that is. Okay, then he claims that he basically rejects tenure and says that if you have a contract for 3 years, the non-Jew after that 3 years is up is still hefker. Because you haven't dealt with that case. And even though Tosfos explicitly deals with a case where people have a contract to be melamed, and we say, and you're an interloper if you try and replace him after that contract is up. So he makes a very creative distinction between short-term and long-term contracts, which he makes the claim, it's a fascinating claim, short-term contracts carry with them the expectation of being rolled over.
Who's arguing?
Marik says that short-term contracts have an expectation of being rolled over, but long-term contracts, right, do not carry with them the expectation of automatic renewal. And therefore, even though Tosfot says that if you try and hire yourself out for after someone else's contract expires, that you are an Mahapek Becharara, that's not true in this case because it was a 3-year contract.
Which counts as short-term or long-term?
3 years is long-term. Okay. Right? So since this was a long-term contract, mm-hmm. therefore he had no reasonable expectation of the contract being rolled over. And then, insult to injury, because in his naivete, believing the contract would be automatically rolled over, which was a mistake, he didn't start negotiations about what would happen afterwards, so he's not even Mahapech anymore. So there hasn't been any tircha. Even though Reuven went to all this effort to get the first contract, the fact that he has not yet entered negotiations...
This is like similar to the argument we make about Nafal Alale or Paras Talitalale. How can it be that the guy didn't take ownership of it? And it's because he didn't say he wanted to acquire it. Because he thought that by doing something...
Yes. Right, Reuven was a fool. And Reuven believed that long-term contracts would roll over automatically. But that is a dumb thing to think. And Shimon didn't have to know that Reuven would think this dumb thing that contracts would roll over automatically. So therefore, Shimon is not interloping. And then because Reuven, in his false belief that contract would roll over automatically, didn't open negotiations on the second contract the day after he concluded the first contract, therefore he hasn't put any effort in, and therefore Shimon, therefore A is hefker. Right? This is how he accomplished it. Right? A is hefker. Because after the term of the contract, nothing has been done. And B, it's hefker without tircha, because Reuven hasn't entered negotiations yet. And now he has his client completely off the hook. Then he has a whole set of arguments that are not really our issue. The real chiddush he has, I think that the most creative move that he has in the entire tshuva, about which he has absolutely no precedent, really the only precedent he has against him is Tosfot. Right, so we should talk that at length. Right, Tosfot says in the Melamed case that you are an ani mahapik becharora if you hire yourself out afterwards. So he has two solutions. One is that's a short-term contract, and short-term contracts don't carry the expectation of automatic renewal, whereas long-term contracts don't. But then he has a problem that there seems to be a case in a different Rishon who says that it is a long-term contract. So then he says it depends. There's a long-term contract when there is no local competition. Now, a long-term contract with no local competition, you have an expectation of automatic renewal. But a long-term contract in an area when you know that you got the contract even though other people locally were trying for it, you have to expect them to keep on trying to get it back. Right? So these are, right, but the bottom line is he has no evidence for his distinction. He has two Rishonim who are against his distinction, which he distinguishes by developing this very cool theory of expectations regarding contracts, which you can decide for yourself. Is this a plausible theory or is it not a plausible theory? In some places, it might be other places, like say, that every walk into town, that Mr. Darcy hires a new governess every 3 years, right? You walk in, right? Who knows? I'm not sure, not implausible, but not unsure. But I think he has. Now, if we turn to the, I think that one of the really biggest arguments that matters for him is in...
that was the most creative move? Or are you just
so I think that was the most creative move. I think that right, his claim that this is a case of Hefker, that's Rabbeinu Tam, and it's not a case of Tirfa, so it doesn't fit into the exception of Rabbeinu Tam, because he sets up the expectations in such a way that the person had no right to expect the contract to be renewed, so it's Hefker. And then it happens that the person didn't make an effort to renew the contract. Why? Because they expected it to be renewed. So he's not Mahapech either, so there's no Tircha. Right? That's a very clever. Right? That's a very clever argument. But it's not an argument you would make, I think, if you were just interested in deciding the case without any bias. It's too clever. Yes, so.
Did you guys talk about
No. Okay, so, yes.
I wonder why it's such a novel approach, why other people haven't thought of it earlier. I mean, why haven't we made the distinction before that competition may be allowed on short-term versus long-term contracts?
I don't know, maybe because social expectations changed, maybe because no one thought of it, because it's really not it.
It's brilliant.
It's brilliant, but it's not intuitively obvious.
Pardon? Meaning, you have to buy it in order to think that it's brilliant.
Okay, it's at least clever.
Yeah.
Yes, Jen.
Did we let go of Yoruba Monotone? I mean, we didn't get to the
region. He has never... Right.
I mean, even if you get to the Terha exception, doesn't... I mean, it's kind of... Isn't there a
that is a good point. I don't know if he ever gets back to the... I don't know if he ever gets back to the Yoruba Monotone case, except insofar... as the assumption is that this is how people do their amanut by competing for these contracts. But maybe, let's say one thing. So I want to talk about section 11V. Okay, we know where 11...
CV.
11CV, yes, thank you.
I mean, just
to clarify. So 11CV, so anybody know where that is?
I think it's in the middle of the wall of text.
Okay. It's going to be on page 16 or 17.
Great, that's my favorite page.
Okay, so we're on page 17. Page 17, and we are 7 lines down.
Can you try double spacing?
How much will it cost in paper?
Not significantly more than this.
Twice?
So you'll have to double space the pages.
Okay. Well, I didn't get as far as formatting these pages, but here we are. So on, so on page 17, 7 lines down.
You don't have
17.
Okay.
17. Page 17, 7 lines. 7 lines down. He says, "Oh, mard the samchadate, the atu." Okay, so he introduces a whole new factor in which he says, you know what, there's no point in restraining Jewish competition because this is not an exclusively Jewish field. Right, and that, I think, is probably the most compelling, and I wonder if it's not the argument that underlies all this. That he says, what's the right? You're trying to treat this as if it were a marufia, but a marufia is about an exclusive relationship between a Jew and a non-Jew, where non-Jews cannot compete because they can't moneylend. But here we're talking about getting licenses to be whiskey resellers, and before this guy got it, right? So some local Gentile nobody got it. So you're running a court case, right, against one Jew for interfering with another, but that's right. But all that's going to happen is. If you let this first Jew be complacent and to rest on his laurels, I got the contract, what's going to happen in the end is not that he's going to keep his contract. What's going to happen is that the Jewish community is going to lose the contract. Right, so I want to say that that's really the overarching thesis he has here is that the Mora was in the wrong economic structure. He was treating this as an environment in which the Jewish community exclusively controls the business, and the purpose of restraints on competition, as I argued, is that it's inefficient for the Jewish community to spend its energy competing for business that it already has. The only benefit of those are the non-Jewish consumers. But here, if you let a Jew be complacent, all that's going to happen is a non-Jewish competitor is going to come in. So the community loses by restraining competition here, whereas in the other place it gains. That is what I think is really going on in the Maharshal, and all the other arguments are window dressing. Because probably that argument hasn't made headway yet. People haven't quite gotten the idea that that's what the economic situation is. But that argument, to me, wins. Right? That argument is completely dispositive. Yes.
Yeah, Marshall doesn't believe in using other arguments to address
him. Marshall didn't believe in it. He said he didn't believe in it. Okay, he said he didn't believe in it. They're not false, but they're not. But I think that at the end of the day, the argument that drives him.
Has to actually believe that the guy is told the Mishnah, right? Unless you really, really want to claim it's a forgery.
No, it's not a forgery.
It could be Toevim. You could claim that the person was...
He has to believe the other person is Toevim Dvar Mishnah, but then you have the question. He has to, what is his standard for Toevim Dvar Mishnah, how does he have to go to convince you that he's right, that he's Toevim Dvar Mishnah? I don't know. I assume he makes all these arguments sincerely, but I also think that he makes these arguments sincerely because he believes there is an equity issue. And I think what ultimately drives the equity issue is that he thinks that this is an illegitimate claim by the first party because he's holding Shimon liable for something he would have lost anyway. Because if Reuven goes on this way, just assuming it's going to continue, right? So we're allowing a bad businessman to hold on to an asset that belongs to the Jewish community. Okay, yes, Judah.
But then he still doesn't win if this is the best argument. Because this would be
a time of Shikol Da, so I think that's part of why he doesn't make the argument in those terms. I think he recognizes that this is just an alien, right? This is coming in and saying you're in the wrong universe, and so he doesn't make the argument formally that way. And I wonder, right? It'd be fun if somebody's writing history to try and figure out, like, at what point, right, is there a point at which people start, right, which we stop having uniquely Jewish businesses, right? What are the areas, right? And particularly, what's the whiskey economy in Poland? In the
Fran?
Fran might know it. Yeah, right. See what the whiskey economy is. So I say this out, as a someone who only reads text, so I have no knowledge of history at all. Right? That to me is far and away the coolest argument in the Tshuva. And if he's right empirically, then it's an absolutely dispositive argument, but we should say it is also an argument that doesn't appear in the Gemara. Right? The same way as the other argument. The Gemara never talks about the question, Ani b'hapech b'charara, and you're chasing it, and so is a non-Jew. Right? You're not a Russia because a non-Jew, you're not a Russia anymore because a non-Jew would get it without you. Right? That never shows up in the Gemara. So this is also a creative distinction. And the reason it doesn't come up before to some extent is either because it was obvious or because we lived in economically segregated areas. But I think it's a, and I think that's why this is the tshuva, in a sense, which brings these halachos into modernity. Right? Because it's the tshuva which says we don't really control the economy. But what do we do?
Is that why all the discussion is about a model? I mean, if all the businesses you can imagine, sort of playing, yeah. Why is this discussion tee off on Marufia? Like, as if that's the only... Right, but you might be giving the answer, which is because that's the place, right, where it's really because the non-Jews are frozen out of the market. This is sort of right, the modern equivalent of this is why with the pizza store, right? Why that business? Well, because you need a kosher certificate, so you've now got to go to the internal forum or the rabbi in the shul, right? There's a couple of places where we think about sort of Hosh and Mishpah categories contemporarily. And they're all because, for one reason or another, this is an intra-Jewish business.
Yes.
As soon as you leave that, right, you don't have it, which is his point. Now, I wonder then, because I was always wondering why the Marufia is the paradigmatic case here. You might have just given the answer, right, which is because until a certain point, that's the equivalent of something that only Jews can do because non-Jews won't compete. And then as soon as you transfer to the liquor license, right, he's like, we're back. Now it's like everything else, and everything else we never worry about.
Right, except that I think that liquor licenses are a middle ground.
Right,
because
no,
right? Lots of areas where Jews dominate the market.
Right.
Right, and so the right, and so
it's
we.
Like diamonds.
Pardon?
It's like diamonds.
Yes. Right, so that's a fair question, right? What, let's diamond market now. Right, the diamond market now would be a fun test case because.
Because all the Indians get.
So, right, and really, there's a transitioning point, right, where you could have said 20 years ago, nah, it's all Jews, right, or right, or you know, or cameras, right, and the market is shifting. So this may very well. I think the Gemara deals with a holistic Jewish economy. Right, you move to the Middle Ages, where really you're dealing with a Jewish economy where the major economic engines are the relationship of the Jewish economy to the non-Jewish economy, and the intersection point is Marufia. Right? And here you have a transition, the Jews transitioning into becoming more broadly involved in the economy, and right, and that's going to cause a whole revolt. And I think this is a critical moment, right, when he makes this argument, and I think it's winning. Okay, last question, then we're going to break.
I'm totally into it. It's a breath of fresh air. It's very clear. But just literally, it's stuck in 11 CV as a va'od ha'al kodesh. Like, it's just clearly not actually the bottom line of his tshuva.
So now we have to figure out, it's not the bottom line of his tshuva, because it's not the way the formal argument is going to win. The question is it the motivating force of his tshuva?
I mean, that, even if Eliyahu were to come and tell me that, it's hard to know. I'm just saying, you would think that he would use it more explicitly, unless you're going to make up something. He was afraid of people saying the Jews should be. I don't know.
Fair argument. And I wrote the outline, so I can't deny that it's an 11 CV. fair. Yes.
Just really remind me who it is that we were just reading that said that. No, there's no point in the Jewish community wasting time.
I argue that the rationale
wasn't it connected.
Yeah, I was arguing. Pardon?
I'm just trying to connect it
with myself. I was arguing that the rationale rationale for allowing monopolies in Marufia but not allowing them elsewhere was precisely that.
Okay.
And that's why we think that was the key issue, because there is not, and that we have to reconsider. That was the we talked about in the Ravon, right, where the Ravon in terms of the Mavui Sassum, right, which Josh has now found that the Beit Ephraim have said, we're not going to do the Beit Ephraim this year, so it's okay to send it out. We're not going to have time to get to the Beit Ephraim, but that he pointed out that the Ravon is actually talking about a case where all the customers are not Jewish, so we have no interest in the consumer, right. And I just kept pointing out it makes a big difference that basically what the point I kept making was that. Monopolies are inefficient only if you control the whole economy. They're very efficient if you control part of the economy, and the part of the economy you control is the sellers and not the buyers.
Right.
Right. So Marufia is a case where we control the sellers and not the buyers, so we engage in it. And so what the Marshal recognizes here is that there are certain kinds of commerce that are no longer control the sellers entirely, and therefore we have to rethink the whole model. Yes?
So just to support you against Avinola's claim, right? No, I also had this problem with, because it's nothing in here, literally, but you could say that he makes a number of arguments you didn't think he needed to make that go along with the idea that we're in a transition point, namely that he attacks the idea of Ma'arufia and says we're no longer there. He attacks in sort of how he views how we're supposed to interact with non-Jews, how he attacks the idea that all non-Jews probably have to get, no, it's only this certain case. So there's a lot here that I don't think it's needed, but he adds, possibly that shows that he's...
Very good. Very good. I think the Marufia point is actually a very powerful point. That he goes out of his way to tell you that there's nothing like Marufia nowadays.
Right.
Now, why is there nothing like Marufia nowadays?
Yeah.
Right? So I think that's a very powerful point. All right, excellent. Thank you. Let's break till 3:30. That was fun.
Do you think that you could say... is it just a brother he's worried about protecting...
Good hustle.